my official job right now is to introduce our moderator, Jackie Judd, who in turn will introduce our speakers and our panel. But I just want to take a moment to comment on the fact that this, and we will have people coming in late because this is a late breaker. I assume all of you heard about it by word of mouth or on the app. It's not on the official program. But I think it speaks to the specialness, the uniqueness of Spotlight Health that within 24 hours we will be able to get this incredible moderator, these incredible speakers to speak about and talk with you about a topic that is on the front page of every single newspaper in the country. So we're delighted. I have special thanks to both of you in particular, and of course always to Jackie. Mm-hmm. So let me then introduce our panel, our session on families in crisis at the border. What is the impact, and particularly the health impact, on children? Jackie Judd, our moderator, is a communications consultant specializing in the nonprofit sector. She moderates conferences and trains people in public speaking and delivering TED Talks. She previously was a long-time journalist who reported for the PBS NewsHour, ABC News, and NPR. She covered politics, social policy, and so much more. I first met Jackie when she worked with the Kaiser Family Foundation, where she focused on health policy communications and the international AIDS epidemic. And since then, we've become not just good colleagues, but very good friends. So it is my great pleasure to turn the program over to Jackie Judd. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Ruth. And thank all of you for choosing to spend the opening moments of Spotlight Health 18 with us. Thank you. So let's get started. Quote, "The kids showed up in our driveway on a Tuesday afternoon. Their panic was palpable. The little one didn't sleep so much as lose consciousness in moments when her small body demanded a break from her otherwise ceaseless crying. Sometimes her cries went the other direction too, spiking into screams, her body rigid with terror." Those are the words of Janine Cummins, a former foster mother who wrote a very moving op-ed piece the other day in the New York Times, and it is about the arrival of two foster children who had suffered trauma before arriving at her family's home. And I think it is an appropriate image to hold in our mind, that of a child who cannot be comforted, an appropriate image to hold in our mind as we have a conversation about the health impact of the 2,300 or so children who have been separated from their families at the American border and put in detention centers. Yes, the president issued an executive order, as some of you may know, yesterday, stipulating that in the future families will not be separated. However, there is no stipulation in that executive order about reuniting the 2,300 kids who have already been separated. And there have been very conflicting statements from different quarters of the Trump administration about what exactly the future holds for this group. So with that introduction, now let me turn to our wonderful panelists. Dr. Colleen Kraft, to my immediate left, is the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She practices medicine in Mission Viejo. I have to say parenthetically that Colleen told me before we started, this will be her 49th interview since Friday.
Yes.
So let's make it a really special one.
Thank you.
And Ann Thomas is the president and CEO of the Children's Place, which is in Kansas City. The Children's Place specializes in treating children under the age of eight who have suffered trauma. And Anne, this is the first of, I think, three or four interviews you will be doing over the next couple of days. So welcome to you both. Colleen, I want to start with you. As some of you in the audience may have read or seen Colleen in recent days, you made a visit to a detention center on the Texas-Mexican border. This was back in April.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tell me today, in mid-June, what images, what impressions remain with you?
Sure. So I was asked to come and see what was going on at the border by some of my pediatric colleagues who were saying that kids are being separated from families and we're really worried about these kids. And so I was able to visit one of the tender care shelters that was run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement back in April. And we went in there and said hello to the staff and heard that they do in fact have some social work and some medical folks who come and work with the kids. And then we went into the toddler room. And you've all seen toddlers. When toddlers get together, they're running around, they're rambunctious, they're falling down, they're throwing things, they're very active. This room was eerily silent. There were about 15 children in there. And most of the kids were sitting down or looking and maybe quietly playing with a toy. And there was one little girl who was taking up all the attention in the room, and she was not quite 2 years old. And she was just sobbing and wailing and beating her little fists on the mat and inconsolable. And next to her was one of the staff workers. And I have to tell you, these folks were what looked to be very kind to these children. And she was trying to give this child a toy or give her a book or do something to distract her because she wasn't allowed to pick her up and hold her and wasn't allowed to actually put hands on her and comfort her and soothe her. And the look of helplessness on her face matched the look of horror and terror on the faces of these little toddlers. And for those of us in the room who saw this and saw just how abnormal this was, we could feel the trauma that was going on there. And we knew that these kids needed their parents. And this little girl would stop crying if her mother was there, but we couldn't bring her mother to her. And that just gives you such a feeling of helplessness with these little guys.
Do we know why the staff could not touch the children?
I don't know why the policy exists that they're not allowed to pick them up and hold them. Now, they can change their diapers, they can give them food, they can give them toys, but they're not allowed to actually pick up a child and comfort them. And when you've got very, very young children, children who are really pre-verbal, that's a tough thing.
And when you hear this story and you work with children of trauma for many years now, what sets off your alarm bells?
Oh, there's so many items right there that are just really hard to hear. The situation first, but right away, I see opportunities for ways we could be mitigating what's happening. Heart and still not being able to reach out and do what is natural in caring for a child is to touch or to soothe, to be able to create that relationship that will make a difference. That's even harder to hear at times.
Who are the children who are most susceptible to long-term damage? Because I think that's really the central question here. What happens to a child's mind and body when they're put in this situation?
So it's important to understand the physiology of stress and stress hormones and what that does to the developing brain. So little guys, 0 to 3 year olds, their brains are developing rapidly. And you can see their skills develop day to day. You can see new words, you can see new actions. And that represents a normal brain building the right architecture. What we know about young children is that this brain needs to be developed deliberately. If it's not, then we have long-term consequences for this. So for the youngest children, having that separation induces their stress hormones to come at a high level and not be buffered by a loving and caring parent, somebody who can help them work through some of the stress hormones in their system. So these kids have fight or flight all the time. They're on red alert. And the younger they are, the more likely they are to develop long-term damage because of this. And we see this in kids. We see this disrupting their brain architecture. They don't develop speech. They don't develop the social-emotional bonds that need to be there. They don't develop gross motor function sometimes. And it leads to, in the very short term, very significant developmental delay.
I've heard you use the phrase toxic stress. Is that something that's used in the field?
Absolutely. When a child is living in a situation where their cortisol levels are raised and elevated for a long period of time, it does change the brain architecture. It changes how they respond. That it influences them in a way that they have to adapt because we're adaptive creatures. And so they grow around with that in them, and that's where we start to see the maladaptive behaviors. We start to see the unhealthy relationships because their brain has started to respond to things differently. So then when you begin to create a healthy relationship for them, that is not their truth. That feels foreign to them. And that's where it gets complicated, that even in the healing process, when we reintroduce what would be healing factors, that's foreign to them. And that creates another level of intervention we have to use.
You've both used the expression, the architecture of the brain. When the architecture of the brain changes in this period of time, is it a permanent change?
So it is. And just to explain that a little bit, what happens is that you are born with a number of synaptic connections, which are neural connections, and those connections increase in number and increase in strength over the first 3 years of life. And what happens eventually is the brain begins to prune some of those less strong connections away. So in the very early years, if those strong connections that get built are responsiveness, language, singing, counting, playing, reading, then what develops, the strong connections that develop are language skills, they're social emotional skills, they're the ability to learn, they're the ability to be resilient. But in these children that have these high stress hormone levels, what happens is that those relationships and those normal bonds aren't the strong connections. The strong connections that are built are fear, aggression, anxiety. And as these kids grow and develop and their brain starts pruning away some of these connections, the strong connections stay. So with normal brain architecture, you will keep the ability to read, the ability to write, the ability to love and learn. And a bad experience that may have happened to you and your child will get pruned away. With these kids, the fear is that the strong connections of fear and anxiety and pain and hurt are the ones that stay, and the ability to learn new things, the ability to read, will be pruned away.
And you've identified age. The youngest children are at the greatest risk of suffering these effects that you've been describing. What are some of the other risk factors? Does it have to do with the length of separation from their family? Does it have to do with the circumstances from which they've come? They've all come to the border under arduous circumstances. What are the risk factors you look at, Anne?
Well, I think you've named the risk factors. I think the challenge is it's different for every single child, because with risk factors there also arise resiliency factors. So their temperament, their relationships, is there a sibling in the camp with them? Again, what other traumas have they experienced before this? You know, if they've been in homes where there's been violence, if there's been lack of basic needs, if there has been a change in caregiver from a mother to a grandmother. All of those things are risks that normally children can move through. Natural stresses are okay. Harder stresses, we still can move through. But when you compound those, we end up with, and then a large stress like this, where you remove the primary caregiver, we're looking at children that could have complex trauma. And that is, so there isn't one thing that is predictive, that it will say this is the worst thing. It is the culmination of all of those events.
So let's get granular for a moment. Just before coming over here, I was reading the news, as I always do because I'm obsessed. There was a story in the New York Times that an undocumented worker from Guatemala, a woman who had crossed the border and was separated from her son 1 month ago, will be reunited with her son. He's a 7-year-old. Who will be the child she's getting back, and how will he be different from the child she knew a month ago?
He will look like her son, but he may not respond the same way. In those times, he's experienced fear. He's been in an unknown situation and had to adapt. And it's not uncommon for young children at this age, clearly have no understanding. This is a grown-up situation that we're struggling to understand. Put over a young brain. That's a mismatch right there. So a child is not going to understand what just happened. And we have to remember that young children are also very egocentric. And it's not uncommon to think, Mom, why did you leave me?
Right.
And to blame, what did I do wrong? And so right then she is a child that's gone through all of this, but he may not just run into her arms and say, "Mom, I'm so glad we're safe, we're back together." We suddenly have to repair that bond between them and then also help them both heal from what's happened. We have just exponentially increased the amount of healing work that's going to have to happen.
And you'll see differences in the way that kids are eating and sleeping and disruption of a number of behaviors. And the fear that, is this going to happen again? Are you going to stay with me now? Are you going to leave me? What if I do something wrong? Does that mean you're going to leave me again? And that's part of that complex trauma that really requires trauma-focused therapy in order to help to heal that bond, even with a loving parent and a child who wants to see and wants to be with their parent.
Let's turn now to the strategies. You mentioned therapy, and particularly at the Children's Place, what works? I know that there's no secret sauce, there's no single formula, but what's the range of strategies that work to help children work through trauma and somehow come out on the other end?
Right. Well, and I think this is why I do this work, is because the healing happens. Where I work, we work with children, again, under the age of 5, that have experienced on average 5 different traumatic events in their young lives. When they arrive in our program, we call them the deer in the headlights. They're just paused. They are not ready for relationship. They are scared and frozen. Or the other group that arrives is our externalizers. They have been kicked out of multiple early ed centers, and no one can manage them. They're aggressive. They are prickly. And they're yo-yo kids, come in, I'll push you away. So we see all these different types of behaviors that manifest after traumatic events. The very first thing, safety, predictability. We say it all the time, we're here to keep you safe. And we start with consistent routines. Every day feels like the same. And sometimes people are like, gosh, do you shake it up a little bit? Nope, that brain needs to be rewired. That brain needs to know when you walk in, you're going to be greeted by Miss Kathy, and she is going to do this. So we start with routine and consistency and predictability. Very next, we add relationship. We have amazing staff. They're just like those warm caregivers, but they're highly trained in understanding the nuances of what's going on. And so building protective relationships. I will come and join with you as you're ready, but I'm going to keep coming to you. You're not going to push me away. Our staff learns to not take it personal. You know, trauma kids have been hurt, so they're really, really good at keeping people away. I'll do it myself, you won't hurt me again. And so teaching people that we've got to ride through this, and when you do, you start to see something change. As we do each of those two basic steps, with therapies, with fun, play, life has not been fun, so we have to do lots of child-centered, be a kid. Go outside and blow bubbles, run, get dirty. Lots of sensory activities to bring feeling back into their bodies and their minds. That's when we start to see things turn. And our children stay for about 15 months. So that is the power of the young brain, that it can be rewired. Children are resilient when those ingredients are put back in place and when people understand the complexity of the baby steps that have to be done. We see them laughing, giggling, teasing, joking, breaking limits or pushing limits, making messes, and those are all really happy things that we see in children.
And during that 15-month period when there are responsible, loving adults in these kids' lives, what kind of training goes on with them?
You know, it is always about trying to find who will be the one person that can help protect them.
Yep.
And it can be lots of different people. We use a strategy. Our children are in foster care, and so I pause when we answer that because it's not always the same person.
Right.
And so we teach strategies that your heart is very big. It's a pocket, and everyone that comes into your life and gives you love makes your heart bigger, because sometimes it's grandma for 6 months, and then, you know, mom's in the process of being reunified. But we're working to teach them that there are positive relationships. You know, that it's not, it is really important to have the one, but we have to teach them other coping skills as well.
Colleen, the Academy has been very involved in this subject long before the national spotlight has been shining on it in the past few weeks. And you have a toolkit for pediatricians to use when they're treating children who have been through traumatic experiences, particularly immigrant children. What are pediatricians to do?
So pediatricians are looking to, first of all, ensure and make sure that these families are connected with the resources to do one other thing and make sure that that environment is a safe environment for them. And this is a big fear that we have with the reunification of these kids, because we're not sure that that's going to happen well. And then secondly, where are these families going to be? Because we know that a community-based situation is going to be best for these families and children. And having them go from being separated from their parent to living with a parent in a detention center is wrong. And that will only go to re-traumatize these kids. And we know that the ecology, the environment, actually becomes your biology, and that drives development across the lifespan. So what we do is we first of all find those resources, work with our pediatricians on making connections with the legal community and the social work community that can help those families, and then get them involved in some of the trauma-focused care that can really help to repair those relationships.
When the kind of work you've just described doesn't succeed, what does an adult look like who has been through this trauma and struggles with what one writer called the long shadow of this disruption? Who is that adult?
So that adult starts with a child who's been traumatized, and then they go on to not being able to do well in school, and somebody who gets in trouble in school a lot. And they may drop out of school. They may get into trouble with the law. They may start smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol and being involved in substance abuse. And eventually what happens is that the environment, the ecology that becomes their biology, actually drives change. And they are at risk for chronic heart disease, for morbid obesity, for cancer, for a number of the diseases that are actual physical diseases that come secondary to these adverse childhood experiences.
And yeah. I think one other piece of that is also their sense of relationship is different. So you start to see them engage in relationships, whether it's a friend, starts as peers, you know, in elementary right. school, but it moves to partners. We tend to see, again, unhealthy relationships that start to form. This is where we see domestic violence. We see them having children of their own, and because of their own attachment issues, right. their own trauma-related issues, again, their truth, they do not have what we would, you know, see as some of the ingredients to have healthy relationships. So not only are they moving down and having more health risks, but they are influencing others around them with their traumatic responses.
Just to give you an example, I work with a number of children who've been in foster care, and a number of parents who have been foster care survivors. And it's not uncommon for one of these families to have a child, to have a baby, and want to do that because they want somebody who's going to love them. So they'll have this child at a very early age. And then they will become distraught because they think their two-month-old hates them because they're crying at nighttime and they won't calm down and have colic. Or they think that their 12-month-old hates them because they're beginning to test limits like normal 12-month-olds do. So it becomes very complex. Not only are the behaviors part of what goes on, but we know that this trauma inflicts changes around their DNA in something that's called epigenetics, which makes a difference in what types of proteins are being made and how much. And so genetically, this trauma gets passed from one generation to another.
I think it's kind of classically American to want to find a silver lining
right.
in a truly abhorrent story. So let's try to find that. This feels like an opportunity to push this issue forward. People are talking about it, thinking about it in ways that they haven't before. So if this is an inflection point, what changes would you like to see in how people think about childhood trauma and what they do about it?
So I would like to see a coordinated response to childhood trauma. And we can start with these children who have been separated and are being reunited, because they need to be reunited with their families. They need to be in safe situations and not being re-traumatized. And there needs to be increased availability of trauma-focused care for these kids. But as you start talking about these kids, how about those kids whose parents are opioid abusers? Mm-hmm. How about those parents who have been traumatized themselves? The idea of trauma-focused therapy is actually something that we could apply to a number of our parent-child dyads in this country, and to make this aware and to make this available to people who need it is going to be important.
Anne?
Well, I do see this as an opportunity. We're having a conversation about early childhood mental health.
Right.
This is what all of us should be talking about. And what I've found, and what continues to surprise me, is that people don't understand that there are things we do. And I think, again, we're biologically programmed to do them. So if we all stay online and it kind of works, we don't appreciate the nuances and the sophistication of things that are happening. But when it's not there, we teach these things. You may heal from trauma. It does not have to define you. And it saddens me that there's a lack of understanding about this. So I see this as an opportunity that it's created a buzz. And with every time we talk about it, we're educating someone else what early childhood trauma means, the power of connection, the power of buffering against stressful events, and we're learning the biology that goes with it. So this can be a very exciting opportunity for our society.
But on the flip side, there's the whole conversation about prevention, because as pediatricians, prevention is really our mantra, and trauma-focused therapy works, but it's expensive, it's intensive, we don't have enough therapists, we don't have enough resources. How do we make this become part of our prevention policy? We did have one really good thing happen in the legislative sessions in Congress, in that the Families First Prevention Act was put through, and that actually has funding for looking at therapies, looking for resources for families who are struggling. So you might be able to intervene before there's some toxic stress that's there. And that's really the important part there. What do we do in terms of our health care, our behavioral health care, our substance abuse treatments, so that we can stop things in their track and prevent some of the long-lasting trauma that's going to go through?
I'd like to open it up to questions from all of you. There are folks on either side of the room with microphones. They will identify you. This is being recorded and will be posted later on. So if you can stand and let us know who you are, that would be terrific. And let's get going. I think I'm having trouble with the lights, seeing too clearly. Mm-hmm. Oh, there we go, over there.
Well, I have to speak loud. I'm Ira Leshner from San Diego.
Wait, we need a mic.
Okay.
All right, start again, please.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. My name is Ira Leshner. I'm from San Diego, California. Thank you very much for giving us these insights. The second idea that we have to pursue, I believe, is first, reunite these children, mm-hmm. each and every one of them, with their parent. They were not just separated. Mm-hmm. They were kidnapped. Mm-hmm. They were kidnapped. And you and I and everyone within the reach of our voice back home or here have a responsibility, I believe, to bring this message forward in a way that is not political. It's really about innocent children. Forget about the politics part of it. But how do we get the society as a whole to now put pressure on this administration, on the members of Congress of both parties, to remedy the issue of separation or kidnapping? And it would seem to me that the first thing that we have to do is bring it to the fore in the churches and the synagogues and any other organization that we belong to, whether it be the PTA, whether it be the Sunday church, whether it be the Saturday synagogue. We have a responsibility to stand up and to raise this issue and to ask all others to join with us in expressing our dislike, our detest, and our intent to make sure that every single child is united with their mother, with their father, if possible, wherever that may be, and then move to the next steps that have to be the United States' responsibility to remedy this terrible, terrible wrong. Our nation is in crisis. This is not just an event. This, our nation is in crisis, and unless we speak up, we will fail.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Colleen, let me ask you, let us presume for a moment that all of these children will be reunited with family. What happens in the immediate moment after that? What should happen?
In the immediate moment after that, that family should be placed in a community-based setting. We advocate that they not go back to these detention centers, that this is wrong and this is re-traumatizing for these children. So get our kids together back with their families and get them to stay in an environment that's going to be helpful. Our legal system in different communities throughout the United States can work with these families and make sure they come to court and make sure that they show up and are part on their day that's due when they're looking at their asylum status. But let's do this in a place that's healthy for these children.
Question over here.
Mike Bezos with the Bezos Family Foundation. And in our foundation, the early learning, the first 5 years are critical. And everything that you guys have said, it's right on the spot. I want to perhaps be a little more optimistic at this point. And pick up from the point that there is the executive order in place. The next step is reuniting the children that are separated from the parents, reuniting them. So that part of it, I think that is going to be moving forward. I think that what you mentioned in terms of reuniting the parents and the children is critical. What is important is how do we teach, and you touched upon that, Ms. Thomas, is how do we let those parents know how important it is for them to be, to reestablish that relationship that is so critical? And in this case, the parents that we are talking about perhaps themselves are not aware of how important those early years of brain development is and the impact that they may have. So not only unifying the parents and the kids, but also spending time educating the parents about how to behave or how to act and how to reestablish that relationship again. And then the next step is every one of us, I'll call upon every one of us again in this group, when we go back home, sure, go ahead and call your congressman and your governor. But more important, there is a lot of toxic stress going on in your communities right now. It's been going on for many years, and it's still going on, and it's just as separate from the border issue, it's just as critical and just as impactful. So learn a little bit about it, and everything that was said here about the children's brain being very malleable, it's never too late to catch them. But let me tell me a little bit about how can we reach those parents and teach them and share with them about how important this is in this situation at the border. Thank you.
Thank you. Anne?
Well, I think Colleen alluded to that. If there was a way as we are reunifying, and it's not just you go back together and bye, the problem's solved, it is using what we know as evidence-based treatments. It is, you know, all of our evidence-based treatments for trauma are around these very things. It's around relationship building, and it's about how do we help self-regulate. The other piece we have to remember is the parents have experienced a trauma, too. Mm-hmm. So this is not just the child's trauma. The parent has lost their child for this period of time. And so it is going to involve psychoeducation around all of these steps. So if people are aware, there is a recipe that if we follow these things, we will move towards healing. And we are going to have the community supports. Every one of you goes back to your community and says, where are our resources? Where are the therapists, the agencies, the social workers, the teachers that have a trauma-informed lens and understand that we have got to spread this message further? And that's how we will help them heal.
I think part of it, too, particularly for our immigrant families and migrant families, is humanizing them. So rather than what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. And it's rather than you're an illegal crossing the border, you're a human being escaping violence. And something happened to you there. And I think if we can get that message out, and enough of us say it, enough of us made Donald Trump changed the separation of children and parents policy. So enough of us need to be talking at the next steps as well.
It doesn't end. Mm-hmm. Reunification doesn't
end. We have a question on this side.
Hi, I'm Sheila Walker. I am a behavioral geneticist. I work for the Center for Youth Wellness with Nadine Burke-Harris in California. Thank you so much for this very important talk today. I just wanted to add a couple of things, 1,000% echoing the prevention piece. Yes. It's so important that we get out in front of this, not only in early childhood, but during the pregnancy period, even preconception, and reach parents who have been traumatized early on to help them with this early attachment skills and so forth. I also wanted to follow on to Mike's comment on a positive spin from a biochemical standpoint on the epigenetics piece, which I think is getting a bit of a bad rap because it's how we operate as human beings. We're under construction 24/7 because ecology shapes biology or nurture shapes nature. And this just means that when we get the context piece right over time, and it may be expensive and be complex, but it works. And biology tells a very optimistic story about what can happen when we get the context piece right.
Thank you.
Right.
Do you want to add to that?
Well, I would agree with that entirely. And that I think so much of what I've had to say publicly in the last several days has really been about the dangers of what we're doing, because a lot of the public perception is, well, we've got them in a nice place, and they have beds, and they have toys. And you know, it's kind of like time. What we're doing to these young children and their brains is really something that can cause lifelong trauma. And so I think as we move through the now what step, it is looking at what do these families need, and that there is healing that can happen.
Colleen, the first eloquent speaker talked about, let's not make this political. I'm not sure we can do that in these polarized times that we live in. You have been, and the Academy has been, so out front on this, 49 interviews since Friday. Have you been heard, or has there been pushback from certain quarters to what you're saying?
So by and large, we have been heard, and by and large, we've had a very positive response to what we've had to say. There has been rhetoric on both sides, quite honestly. So, you know, the very right wing will, we have laws, and, you know, and again, mischaracterizing these people fleeing violence as all kinds of things that I don't want to repeat. But even on the left-hand side, too, you know, we should be arresting Trump, and we can't go there. We got to be thinking about the kids and the families. And if we put the kids first and the families first, that becomes our North Star, and we can speak to this. And we all want our kids to grow up healthy, and we all want kids that are going to be productive as adults. And so we can coalesce around these things.
Question over here.
Sure. Thanks. My name's Emily Kingsley. And I'm
from Emily.
Hi, I'll be seeing you later. I'm from New York. And I think that it's all well and good to speak, to sing to the choir, because we all know that we're all on the right side and we're all going to do as much as we can. But when there's a pervasive, when you talk about individualizing these children, when there's a pervasive attitude within the administration that these aren't people, and we didn't want them in the first place, and they're brown, and they come from shithole countries, and so they are not... they're not paid the same attention and humanization as if Ivanka and Jared's kid was pulled away and taken somewhere, and they didn't know where they were and didn't know if they'd ever see them again. You would have a very different attitude, or somebody would have a different attitude, about the resolution of these problems. I think there's a very, very basic racism involved in the entire situation.
One of the things I pointed out when Gail King interviewed me on Good Morning, I guess it's CBS This Morning, back on Monday, was that there's this picture that's circulating of Ivanka Trump and her son. And I love that picture. That's showing what we should be doing with every child. That's the joy between a parent and a child. It's that child serving, returning. And every child in this world deserves that. That's what's going to develop their brains.
And I also think, Emily, I think two things can be true, that what you said is true, and what Anne said earlier is true, that as
awful a situation as this is in the moment, it has given an opportunity for voices to be heard that have not been heard before. Do we have a question here? Yes, down here in the front.
Hi, Michael Stubbs from Los Angeles. Thank you again. This has been incredible. I'm sitting here puzzled because I know what we need to do for these people, but we don't do it for our own people. And so I wonder, is there something that we can insist upon, that we can demand our representatives to fund, to produce, for healing for all children? You know, yes, maybe an emergency situation here, but really for the people in our communities on an ongoing basis. Is there a bullet list of things that we should just say to our elected officials, this is what we insist on for all children?
And you probably think about that pretty often, running a nonprofit in Kansas City. What's on your list?
A lot of thoughts just went through my head. If it was as simple as a list, it would have been done. And so that's the naysayer in me. But I think the groundswell, I think this idea that this is what we believe in, this is the value of who we are, and each person that hears this has to make a decision. Is this important enough to me that I will be a voice for someone else? I will talk to a teacher. I will talk to a high school student. Our words have power when we bring them together. And that is what I think is going to create the connections that will make this stronger. I almost think that will move things over time more than an executive order, because people will resist to resist.
I would say as well that beyond our government, let's look at the people who matter. So let's look at our communities and our business community as well too, because our business community knows that if they don't build the next generation, they're not going to have those kids to become the people who work for them and the people who are going to be productive and make their companies productive. And so there's an argument to be made for every one of us in society to put the resources into both the prevention and the intervention.
There's another question down here. You don't have to if you don't want to.
Okay, Holly Heffines from Texas. Colleen, you spoke about a policy at the detention center on the border that the workers are not allowed to touch the children or comfort them. When did that policy?
I do not know. I mean, this is what we were told when I was there and watching this child. So I don't know any more of the details about that.
There's been some reporting because of your comment.
Right.
And I think that journalists haven't gotten to the root of it, and it may not be that it's written down, but there's an assumption that there are limits on how caregivers can touch children in this age in which we live.
Yeah.
Anyone on this side?
Hi, I'm Nick Nguyen. I'm a family doctor at Beth Israel in Boston. First of all, thank you so much for this. It's really insightful. I don't mean to belabor the point of the gentleman in the front row, but you know, we are seeing more and more children growing to adolescence with health problems, mental health issues, diabetes, mm-hmm. obesity, asthma, anything that you can name, it's there. And there's such a shortage in terms of pediatricians, primary care physicians, and also mental health providers, especially for this pediatric population, also adolescent population. If we know, or if we make the assumption that a lot of this is starting so early on, not just with this atrocious event, but in other scenarios of separation, like substance use disorder and lower socioeconomic status, do you think that there's anything specific that we can do? I mean, I understand the connection of voices and community, and that's all very well and good, but I think we do need something specific so that later on down the line, 10, 20 years from now, we're not at a shortage of primary care physicians, pediatricians, and mental health providers.
So I think as a doctor, The strategies that I've used have been really connecting very closely with some of those community resources. Let me give you a real specific example. In practices that I've been in, we will co-locate with a local home visiting organization. Because if you really want to get down to it, much of building that child's health has to do with that mother-child bond in the very beginning. And some of our mothers are depressed, and some of them have been through trauma themselves, and they don't have the equipment to do that. So how do we have somebody from a home visiting organization co-locate in our practice, help us out when that parent screens positive for maternal depression, and then immediately become the eyes and ears of how we care for that child through how we care for that maternal child dyad? So those are the sorts of things that you on the ground can do. Meet those people who work with these families and start with one. Start with one organization that you're going to co-locate, that you're going to work together with to improve the health of your population.
Ann? The cost of training providers, the cost of giving money to hire another therapist is much less than what the long-term cost overall for a child who's been abused or hurt throughout their lifespan. So it is good economics to invest early in these young children. I do think it's this interfacing, the embeddedness of co-locating where families meet are with mental health folks is really powerful. There's a stigma associated with mental illness. And we've got to change that, that it's not about illness, it's about health. You bring your child to get shots. You bring your child when they're not feeling well. Well, how do we teach families that they bring their child when they're pretty anxious or they're really depressed? Do families know that? I believe we need to start early on. I think high school is an amazing time to start teaching, you know, that age child what it means to notice these things. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's changing this culture that this just becomes part of our vernacular.
One more question. I think on, do we have anybody? Down here? Oh, a gentleman up there.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Thank you for a very stimulating talk. I'm Anthony from East Africa, Kenya. I want to move from the issue of separation because I believe separating children from parents should be a no-no and it should never happen. But maybe my question is looking at the other side, where there is separation because of either a maternal death or because a major problem happens with the mother. Is there a difference between the levels of trauma between the children where the parent, one of the parents dies, and the children who are separated, like what is happening at the border?
So great question. So the question being, is there a difference between a child who's been through a super traumatic event like a parent dying and these kids who've been separated from the parents? The answer is that it all depends on whether they've got a caring adult to help them buffer that situation. So in the instance where a child has a parent who dies, if they've got the other parent, if they've got a grandparent, if they've got an adult who can really help them buffer the stress that they're feeling and work towards a new normal for them, that's something that we call tolerable stress, and it's something where kids can eventually develop that resilience. That contrast that with toxic stress, where these kids are on red alert all the time and they don't have that adult to really help them calm down. Big difference.
So I started this conversation noting that Colleen had done, this will be her 49th. She is racing off now to do her 50th, a live interview with CNN. So we're going to wrap this up, but I want to thank all of you for participating, and most of all, both of you.
Thank you. Thank you.